Okay, it's time to get started this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I think Mark shouts that really loud, just as a way of having a bell. It's time to get started. We're going to continue our study that Mark began with us. Mark is out of town this weekend. He's in Florida. So we're still using his Amazed by Jesus, Volume 1, that Mark has written. And you know, since he's not here this morning, we can talk about him or we can talk about his book, which I plan on doing a little bit. We're going to be on page 81 in his book, which is his Lesson 5. But really, honestly, something about the material Mark has put together. He's got, as you're aware, Amazed by Jesus, Volume 1 and Volume 2. I don't know how long it took him to put these books together, but he has done a lot of work to organize this material. And someone who thinks like I do, the way he's arranged this material is really beneficial. So if you haven't taken a lot of time to look at how he's arranged the material, the books themselves, a couple of things I wanted to point out that I think are really helpful. And I don't think when he started this class with us in the auditorium, he maybe mentioned some of these things, but on page 2 of his first book, he talks about the gospel harmonies, and he explains what those harmonies are. Because you know, of course, the Gospels, the four books we refer to as the Gospels, have a lot of the same material covered. Some of the material is unique to one of the accounts, and there's a lot of overlap. And so what people have done in these harmonies is try to go back and put all these stories, all these occurrences, into chronological order and arrange them so that, for instance, the Sermon on the Mount is assigned a section. And it helps us to kind of arrange and see where all these events take place. And so, for instance, like I said, Sermon on the Mount is section 54. And by doing that, you can go to those sections and see which of the Gospels cover that and where that material is. So there has been someone who has assigned a section number to each of the events in the Gospel. And so what you find in Mark's material is he has referenced those sections. And I think that's really helpful to kind of organize, in my mind, when the events occurred and how many different gospel accounts cover those. Sometimes it may seem like an event happens two or three times, and really it's the same event being described in different accounts. The timelines, and we're going to look at a timeline in just a minute here, Mark. In addition to preparing the books, he's prepared the slides for me this morning as well. And we'll look at the timeline to start. But I don't know if you're like me, but having a timeline available when I'm studying something really helps me figure things out. It's important because historical events have a context. And a timeline is a graphical way to represent, you know, where these events fall in the context of greater history. So if you're like me and you have a timeline available, I'll look at timelines for a while, study them, and it helps me make connections. So at the start of each of our lessons that Mark has, he has the timeline. He has the section numbers with those harmonies I just mentioned. He shows, and we'll look at this in a second, the coverage of these events. It's on the timeline, but it shows a coverage per gospel. You can see which Gospels cover these items. And it gives you the chance to look at all that information just quickly. So that's really good. And thirdly, the thing about Mark's material is he's got lots of maps. Which, again, when I'm studying something, I love to have a map to really help me make connections. I like to read war histories just for fun. And one of the frustrations I have when I'm reading a war history is there'll be pages of text describing where the different armies are, where these cities are, the geographical features that matter, in the movements of all these different things. But without a map on the next page, I can never really fully grasp, I don't think, what's happening. But you give me a map, and suddenly things make a whole lot more sense. And so what Mark has done in his material is provided lots of maps, and it shows the movements of Jesus, his apostles, the relationship between these places. And to me, there's a lot of value in that. So I really appreciate Mark's material for that as well. And like I said, I don't know how long it took him to put all this together. But I think really the two books he's put together are a great resource when we look at the life of Jesus. So let's get started this morning. And speaking of timeline, here's the one that Mark has that's kind of his overall timeline for the ministry of Jesus. And what he's done for us this morning, he blows it up, and we can take a look at where we fall. And one of the things to point out, we've seen already, we started in this class talking about the ministry of John the Baptist. And that's seen first, obviously, in the dark color there. And you see the section number shown, sections 20 through 23. You can see below the big box that says ministry of John, the coverage in the different Gospels. So ministry of John is covered in Matthew, Mark, and Luke clearly for the first part of John's ministry. And when the ministry of Jesus starts, which is what we're starting today, it says lesson 5 in gray, opening events of the ministry of Jesus, suddenly the Gospel of John picks up where the other Gospels are going to go silent in this period. Now what happens to the ministry of John when the ministry of Jesus starts? The bigger timeline, the previous one, showed that the ministry of John continues for quite a while. But the ministry of Jesus now becomes the focus. One of the things about this timeline is he shows, and these bars going up and down the page, if I pull back and look at the previous slide, those bars are indicating Passovers. Why would the Passover be something that would be significant for these charts, for these timelines? Yeah, it's a marker of once a year. It's really the only thing in this time that was referred to every year you can have a marker. And so by having these Passovers recorded, we know how many years Jesus' ministry took place. And so he's put those on the chart as well. Let's see what else here. Okay, so just briefly about the ministry of John that we've been talking about. I'm gonna mention that at the time of today's events, from today's lessons, the start of the ministry of Jesus, which is John chapter 1 and 2, the ministry of John the Baptist is what I'm going to call mature. Mature in the sense that by now, John is well known. He's got followers. He has disciples already. In fact, he has by now the attention of the Jewish leaders, right? So I would call that, my own term, a mature ministry. Comparing that to Jesus, where is Jesus at this time in his ministry? Just starting, infancy, okay. There's a contrast here, right? And that's not surprising. John was supposed to come first and prepare the way. So there's going to be a transition now. John's mature ministry and then Jesus' infancy in ministry. It's an immature. And so the things John has are what Jesus is going to be developing. He's going to become well known. He's going to start collecting, starting today, disciples. Does he yet have the attention of the Jewish leadership? Not yet. So how did John develop those things? How did John's ministry mature? Okay, he was directed by the Holy Spirit. He was in the wilderness. Does it happen quickly, do you think? What would make you think that John's ministry was not a quick thing to develop? Right. What was the way of spreading news at this time? Just word of mouth. That's all there was. Was John in a prominent place where he was conducting his ministry? Yeah, he's out in the wilderness, and he's just dealing. His only outreach is just preaching to people that are willing to come into the wilderness. So it's going to take a while, I would think, for that to really develop. Doesn't do any miracles that we know of. It's all in his message, right? Okay. So I think those are all things important to point out. This is something that John had to put in a lot of time into. Was John, do we get the sense that John was devoted to his cause? Yeah, he is absolutely driven and he is incredibly focused. So much so that he becomes known for his ministry, for his action in ministry, which is baptism. Do you know anybody who's so driven that they're known by the one thing they do the most? Can you think of anybody in history other than John the Baptist who even at the time was known as John the Baptist? Not looking back, but when he was practicing baptism, that's what everyone called him. That's John the Baptizer. It's interesting that he's that driven, but that's the kind of person apparently he was. Okay, here's the map for today's lesson. Once again, Mark does a good job of giving us the map. We see in the first location, John declares Jesus to be the Lamb of God. He is baptizing in Bethany on the Jordan, or beyond the Jordan here. Jesus is going to move up to Bethsaida, and he's going to find... I'm going to get ahead of myself here. He's followed by Andrew and John, and then Andrew finds his brother Peter. Also, this is where Philip is going to be. Well, over in Canaan, it shows here, Philip finds Nathanael. And then lastly, in Cana is also where we have the first miracle, water turned to wine. So that's the lesson for today. Jesus is kind of skirting around the Sea of Galilee, and he's going to be doing a lot of ministry in this location. Thoughts or comments so far just on the setup for the lesson today? So here's a table, and you'll find these types of tables in Mark's material. Not the kind of thing I would have noticed without him pointing this out. But this is a table of titles that are applied to Jesus. This is only from John chapter 1. So we see different people. Mostly these are titles applied by men who are meeting Jesus and are obviously early in their relationship with him. One is applied by John the Baptist multiple times, but one of those is by John the Baptist. And only one of those is by Jesus himself. I think it's obviously very interesting that you have all these different titles being applied in such a short span of verses, and it's early in his ministry. So it's probably very significant that we're starting to see these titles, these roles applied to Jesus right from the start. It's kind of painting a picture of what we're going to see about Jesus revealed throughout his ministry. It's kind of a little foreshadowing of what we'll find out about Jesus. Yeah, and that is a very significant one, and John is the one that uses that term, Lamb of God. And he is, I think, pointing to the sacrificial nature of Jesus. And of course, lambs to the Jews back then had that significance. It was obvious to them how that was tied in. Right. Other comments on some of these titles? And we'll come across these as we go throughout the lesson this morning. But it's neat to kind of put those ahead and have a place for us to note as we come across these in the text. All right. And now we're just going to get into the actual text for this morning, starting in John chapter 1, verse 19. The testimony of John the Baptist. We already noted that he is so devoted to his mission that he becomes known by his practice. In verse 20, we see that the scribes and the priest come to ask John a question. And what's the question they're wanting to find out from him? Is that what they ask him? Okay, you're getting ahead. But exactly right. The question is, who are you? That's a very simple question. That's not the question he answers. So he answers a question that they're really asking him, but he doesn't answer the question they ask. So what is his answer to the question of who are you? I'm not the Christ. Okay. Well, that's what they really wanted to know, but that's not at all what they asked him. But he just skips right ahead to where they're going with this. All right. And again, it just shows John understood well what his role was. Right? He was to prepare the way for the Christ. He was not the Christ. And it seems at this time he didn't know for sure who the Christ was, but he knew it wasn't him. And no matter what notoriety he attained, no matter how many people showed up to hear him speak and to be baptized, he knew his role, and he was to prepare the way for the Christ. And he's constantly going back to that. So he tells them, I'm not the Christ. So what's their follow-up question? Okay, so the first question was, who are you? He says, I'm not the Christ. Second question was, who are you?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So now they start, okay, so are you Elijah then? So it's funny that the first question is really the same as the second question, but they're still not getting the information they want. If you're not the Christ, then who are you? Are you Elijah? And what does he say? He's not Elijah. He's not the prophet, but before I move on to that, I'm trying to decide, do I want to get into this yet? According to Jesus, was John the Baptist Elijah?
Yes.
He was, right? Let's take a minute, and let's go ahead and do that now. Let's look at Matthew chapter 11, skipping over back to the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew 11, and we'll start in verse 11, and I'll just read these real quick, because I think it's relevant. Matthew 11, verse 11. And of course, this is Jesus, and he's talking to his disciples about John. He says, verse 11, truly I say to you, among those born of women, there has not arisen anyone greater than John the Baptist. Yet he who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. And from the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and violent men take it by force. For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John. And if you care to accept it, he himself is Elijah, who was to come. Okay, so there's Jesus talking about John the Baptist, very clearly saying he was Elijah. And then just to put a bow on this, Matthew chapter 17, we'll read this one as well. Matthew 17, starting in verse 10. Again, Jesus talking to his disciples. And it says, and his disciples asked him, saying, why then do the scribes say that Elijah must come first? And he answered and said, Elijah is coming and will restore all things. But I say to you that Elijah already came, and they did not recognize him, but did to him whatever they wished. So also the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands. Then the disciples understood that he had spoken to them about John the Baptist. Okay. So the scribes and priests asked John the Baptist, "Are you Elijah?" And he says, "No." But later we see that Jesus says John the Baptist was Elijah. How do we reconcile that? Pardon?
John, Elijah, the Spirit.
Okay. Not literally. John is not literally Elijah. He is...
He's doing the same kind of work.
The same work, right? There's a figurative sense that he's Elijah. Ricardo?
The leaders, those who lead the law, they're looking for the physical Elijah. The scriptural Elijah would be...
Right. Yes, I think you're right. I think they really expected the Elijah to be coming back. And so to answer their question, was he Elijah? No, he's not. But in the sense that Jesus had intended an Elijah to come before him, John was Elijah, right? And so the Jewish leaders, the Jewish people at the time didn't have the same understanding of what Elijah was going to be. And so I think there really was some belief by the Jews that these prophets were actually going to come back. The same prophets who had been killed, or in Elijah's case, taken up to heaven, would actually be returning in a physical form. And so John says, no, I'm not Elijah. I'm not the prophet. That's the next question. So what's their... Oh. Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so Nikki brings out that they were looking for an earthly king, so it's not surprising they would also be confused about Elijah and his role. Did John the Baptist do a good job, do you think, in preparing the way? I see some yes. What makes you think John the Baptist had done a good job? What are some things from the text we might see that would make us think that he was successful in his role? There were a lot of Jews coming out to be baptized, that's true.
Yes. He got the attention of the Pharisees, the leaders,
Gus points out that the leaders were aware of John and he was causing quite a stir. Jeff? Right. Yeah, Jesus compliments John on his focus and his mission. That's true. Yeah. Ricardo? Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And John is constantly making those references, connecting dots for us, for the followers of him, to look to Jesus. And so I would say that John was successful just because of what we see in this chapter. As has been pointed out, the Jewish leadership was aware of John, and they came to ask him, "Are you the Messiah?" The disciples of John, it seems like, are all there because they're expecting the Messiah to come soon. They're waiting for John to tell them who this Messiah is. It seems like at this time in the Jewish history, there is a focus on the Messiah. Everyone's looking for the Messiah. They're aware that there's one coming. They're all seeking, trying to figure out who it's going to be. I think that's really what John was doing. He was making sure everyone was aware there is a Messiah coming. He's going to be among us soon, and everyone has this hyper-focus on the Messiah. They have, obviously, some really poor understanding of what that Messiah is going to be, but they all seem to be aware of that. Ricardo?
A lot of that.
Yeah, that's all part of the context, right? And this Jewish system that's in place has created this fullness of time for Jesus to come at this point and be able to be effective, right? Okay. And I'm bogging down here early on in the lesson material. We've got a lot to cover. I'll keep moving. So, so the second question was, who are you? And then the third question from these Pharisees to John is, well, then who? Who then are you? And his answer was, I am the voice calling in the wilderness, making straight the paths. He, again, refers to his mission. He doesn't answer really about who he is, but what his mission is. I put some notes down here about what that expression meant to them. To be a voice calling in the wilderness and to making straight the paths. We're way out of time here. So that's an interesting thing to look into, but we'll save that for some other time. The last thing I want to know then is, if you're not Elijah, if you're not the prophet, why are you baptizing? That's the fourth question. And did the Jews have baptism as part of their religious services back then, Walker?
Yes.
Okay, yes, there was. Baptism wasn't unknown to the Jews, but it seems to be that it was really focused more on proselytes and bringing people into Judaism. If you were already a Jew, that didn't seem to be something that they would practice. And so the question itself indicates to me that the Pharisees, the scribes and the priests were saying, you're doing something different than what we would be doing. Therefore, you must be somebody who has authority to feel like you have the liberty to come in and start adding to what it is we do, or using baptism in a way that we're not used to. They were expecting somebody. You had to be a prophet. What else would allow you to come in here and start baptizing people? But they don't get an answer. He is just referring them one more time to one who is going to come. I'm just baptizing with water, he says. Someone's coming who is greater than I, who will offer a different baptism. Constantly putting the focus ahead to Jesus. Okay, so I don't know, you know, these priests and scribes were sent by Pharisees in Jerusalem. They get so exasperated with John, they say, look, we have to give these guys who send us some answer. You got to give us something. And this is really all they get, at least recorded in the text. So I don't know how they were received when they returned, but they at least knew when they went back, this is not the Messiah. He says he's not. Okay. So let's skip ahead, talk a little bit about the followers. John 1, 35 through 42 starts with the first group of two, and initially, and then a third. What type of man was John the Baptist? We already said, clearly he's a driven person. Do you think John the Baptist was life of the party, easygoing, fun time kind of guy? We don't get that sense at all. What type of message was he preaching? Harsh, direct, you need to be baptized, confrontational to the leaders at the time. You don't get the sense that he was just a type of guy that people were drawn to just as a buddy, a pal, a friend to hang out with. And yet, he had some devoted disciples. So what does that tell you about these people who were following John? What might we ascribe to them? You think they're just like them? Wouldn't you have to be? To be around somebody who's that direct and that driven, and it's not really a positive message, although he's promising better things to come. So this is not a prosperity gospel. He's not preaching status quo. He's not tickling anyone's ears with his lessons. In fact, they seem to be quite harsh. So I would expect that the men he brought would men who maybe were different than the common Jew at that time. I would expect them to be serious and spiritual. And I would think to spend time as a disciple of John, you had to have a godly perspective. So we focus a lot on these apostles as these uneducated men who were fishermen, but they weren't disinterested in spiritual things. So to be around John and a disciple of John, it indicates to me that you had a very keen spiritual interest, and they may not have been scholars, but they were interested in who John was going to reveal the Messiah to be. So that's where we find ourselves in John 1, verse 35. And this is a couple days after that exchange with the Pharisees. It says in verse 35, again the next day, John was standing with two of his disciples, and he looked up, and behold, he looked up upon Jesus as he walked, and said, "Behold, the Lamb of God." And the two disciples heard him speak, and they followed Jesus. Okay, this is the moment they've been waiting for, probably. They've been with John and hearing about the Messiah to come. And finally, John says, and there he goes. And so how do they react? They just start to follow Jesus. And that had to be a bit awkward, don't you think? I mean, just to literally follow him as he walked. And how does Jesus respond? Yeah, he wants to know what they're doing. Why are you following me? And a conversation is started here. There's very little detail revealed about what is said. But it's obviously Jesus and these two men, Andrew, and it seems like this is John himself, is the second of these two men. They stay with Jesus for the night, and we don't know what was said, but we know the result. The next day, how does Andrew react to his meeting with Jesus? He goes to get his brother right away. Yeah, he says about Jesus what? We found the Messiah. He learned enough in that one night's conversation to know this is the Messiah. And he goes and gets Simon, his brother, brings Simon to Jesus, and we have this brief introduction. And Jesus immediately gives Simon a new name, Peter. We don't know much else, but that's the first three that are recorded for us as disciples. And there's obviously going to be a lot more to the development of these men as leaders. But that's how we get started. Comments on that short section? Glenn? John's disciples are prepared for this escalation, right? They're going to go on with Jesus. We have next recorded for us Philip. We don't know much about how Philip was called. It says Jesus called to Philip, and then now Philip is convinced that Jesus is the Christ. How do we know Philip was convinced? He goes and finds his friend Nathanael, and he says the same thing. We have found the Messiah. I mean, Philip is already on board. Okay, Nathanael's interesting. Some would say this is Bartholomew, the apostle. He's only referred to as Nathanael in John. He's only referred to as Bartholomew in the other Gospels, and never crossed. So that's how they think it's the same guy. But he is interesting as well. He hears from Philip that Jesus is from Nazareth, and his response is what? Can anything good come from Nazareth? Does he not understand the Old Testament prophecies about Nazareth Is that the problem here? That he would kind of poo-poo this whole idea of Jesus being from Nazareth? There is no prophecy about exactly right. There's nothing said in the Bible about Jesus coming from Nazareth. And why is that? He's from Bethlehem. That does fulfill the scripture. He's just lived his recent life in Nazareth. So it's not like we can just, I don't know. Yeah, it's not that Nathanael was missing something here and didn't know his Old Testament. He's been given information that is totally not spoken of prior in any kind of passage. So he didn't get anything wrong here, and apparently Nazareth wasn't anything significant. But he goes from being really a skeptic to total and absolute belief in a very short period of time. How does Jesus accomplish that with Nathanael? Yeah, he says, so Jesus sees Nathanael for the very first time, and he says, here's an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no guile. And Nathanael says, how do you know anything about me? Well, I saw you standing under the fig tree. And that was enough for Nathanael to think, okay, you are the Christ. He calls him the King of Israel right away. And that seems odd. I think you have to really understand a little bit about what Jesus meant when he complimented Nathanael. When he called him an Israelite indeed, it seems that he was saying about his character was, you're the type of Israelite that God intended. You're the type of Israelite that God wanted to have a relationship with. Through all of history, when God's people were being distracted and unfaithful, you're the kind of person that truly was a son of God. And that's really a huge compliment. Nathanael apparently thought that was true of himself, because he said, well, that's me. You know, how did you know that about me? How could you see my character? Well, just from seeing you standing there, that's not normal. And that impacted Nathanael, that God could make such judgments based on really no information. And it seems perhaps that was enough for Nathanael to realize he wasn't dealing with a normal person here. So what limited piece of conversation we have, again, it was enough for Nathanael to be convinced that Jesus was the Messiah. Okay. We have, 5 minutes left? Is that right? 7 minutes left. Okay, let's move to the miracle, because we're almost out of time. The first miracle recorded is in John chapter 2, 1 through 11. What's the setting of the miracle here? A wedding feast, okay. Where is this at? Canaan. Who's there? Who's attending? His mother, his disciples as well, right? What's the problem? Ran out of wine. It's not good. These wedding feasts lasted for days, and to run out of wine was a huge problem. And it apparently made the host family look like a bunch of idiots. It wasn't good to run out of wine. And it seems perhaps that Mary was related to these people, or she was close friends, and she's bothered that they've got this problem. And so it seems she wants Jesus to do something about it. And the exchange between Jesus and Mary is just really interesting to me. I don't know how long you could study this and not be surprised at how this works out. She tells Jesus the problem, right? What does she say? She says, they're out of wine. She doesn't ask him to do anything. She just tells him there's a problem. But because Jesus is God, he knows there's more here than just information. He knows she's asking him to do something. And that may be really the first miracle ever that a man understood what a woman really wanted. Because when I'm told something, to me it's information. But oftentimes when I'm told something, it's actually, I'm being asked to do something and it's implied. I never get that. Jesus understood exactly what she wanted, even though she was just giving him information. And how does he respond to her? It's not my hour. It's not time. Yeah. He pretty much says, this is not my problem. is the first part. Second part, and it's not time yet. So is that a no? Sounds like a no. To me, that's Jesus saying, sorry, it's not going to happen. How does she react? What's her next statement? She takes it as a yes. Because she tells the servant, okay, he's about to tell you to do something, be sure you do it exactly. So this whole exchange is just so peculiar. And the relationship between Jesus and Mary obviously was very, very deep. And they knew what they were saying, even though the conversation says something else entirely, right? Okay, so that's really interesting. He says, it's not time yet. And she says, everybody get ready. He's about to do something. Perhaps. Yeah, and to what part that played in, the fact that this is his mother, and therefore he's going to do something he wasn't going to do normally, or he was just pointing out to her, it's not time yet. Okay, now it's time. I mean, I don't know. Walker?
Yeah, I think Mary is definitely leveraging Jesus. Like, I don't think that she thought that, yes, but let's say Mark asked me to teach class today. I said, Mark, I'll go about that. And then the next Wednesday, he got up and said, no, guys, Walker's teaching class. Right,
yeah.
I need you to be very, very prepared.
Right.
Well, even if I know, gave him a nod to the little note, now all of a sudden, imagine Jesus says to the servants, they're like, okay, Jesus, what do we do?
Right. Yeah. The servants are now at his command. Yeah. Okay, and so what is the miracle? How does he fix it? Yeah, there's just some empty water jars nearby, and there's information about how much, it's like 120 gallons. Total combined capacity. And all he does is tell the servants, just put water in these stone jars. And then he says, okay, now take some out. And they take it out, and suddenly it's no longer water, it's wine. And it's very good wine. The quality is the best. How flashy was that? Rating miracles and, walking on water is pretty flashy. And this, where does this fall? Yet no one knew really what had happened except for the servants, right? It was only obvious to the ones serving the wine out of the jars. So this wasn't a big flashy thing. In fact, it only was effective because those servants had to explain to others what had happened. You couldn't really see anything. There was no obvious flash and spark or anything. It was very subtle. And yet, did it accomplish what he meant to do? Clearly. Nikki? Correct. Right. Those pods. Right. Right. Yeah. It doesn't seem like a flashy thing, and yet the result was very, very impressive. The quality of the wine was far above what had been served. It was an unusual source. It wasn't normal. And then, of course, he's fixed a really huge problem. So what was the impact of this miracle? Does it affect anybody? Okay. Yeah. So his disciples are what's noted here as the ones that were impressed, right? It made an impact on his disciples. His mom? I mean, how did she know? He had never done a miracle before. How does she know he could do this? She knew he was the Son of God. Did she know he was going to start performing miracles? I mean, if he had truly never done a miracle to this point, is what it says in the text, then how did she know he could? Yeah. Right. All the events that are recorded, all the prophecies, all the things she had seen, the signs that had been performed around him, she knew enough to know that this was something that was within his power. And we're out of time. We have to let the kids come in. But the last thing is, they go from here back to Capernaum, and we're going to see a lot of effort starting around Capernaum now, that he's started his ministry with teaching and with miracles. Okay? All right. Thanks, guys.